So the scenario reserve, if a scenario reserve ends up being part of the final principal-based valuation reserve, to calculate that scenario reserve, it requires the use of a financial model that projects not only asset cash flows but liability cash flows, and then the accumulated difference between those cash flows. So it could be a deficit or it could be a surplus, depending on how those cash flows from the assets flow and from the liabilities flow. So it will require the use of an economic scenario generator, and that generator would generate a 30 years worth of interest rates, 30 years of market rates, bonds, equity returns, and the like. The number of economic scenarios that a company will have to use will be governed by an actuarial standard of practice, but it could be anywhere from running 1,000 to 10,000 or more economic scenarios. So a stochastic scenario, one scenario consists of a set of interest rates or equity returns over a time horizon, and because life insurance is long-tailed business, that time horizon is typically 30 years or more. So a single scenario would track annual interest rates, project annual interest rates for the next 30 years. That's one scenario, and keep in mind we would be generating, say, 1,000 or maybe even 10,000 of those 30-year movements in interest rates or equity returns. And the model the reserve that actually gets held is the greatest present value of the accumulated deficiency over that model time horizon. So say you're projecting out your asset and liability cash flows, maybe year 17, 17 years after you initiated the model, maybe that's the worst results for some reason. So that worst result would be discounted and then would become the greatest present value of those 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 scenarios. And then the scenario then would be the starting assets that I started with in my model plus this greatest present value of accumulated deficiency. So as I had indicated, the companies under the principles-based valuation approach can use their own experience to the extent that it is credible. And so it'll be very critical for insurance regulators to capture this experience data on a company-by-company basis. And so one of the amendments to the standard valuation law was Section 13, was a new section that was added, and it essentially says a company shall submit mortality, morbidity, policyholder behavior, or expense experience, and other data as prescribed in the valuation manual. So that's in the law. It's required that companies submit this data. Within the valuation manual, Section 50 and Section 51 deal with the experience reporting requirements of a statistical agent and the statistical plans, i.e. the format of the data that's going to be collected and how specific the experience data is. And so the idea that this framework envisions is that there will be a statistical agent that will work with the companies to collect the individual company data. That individual company data will be combined to generate an industry experience data table. And industry experience is still important because if a company doesn't have credible data, they've got to use some data in their modeling, so what data would they use? Well, they would use the industry average or industry experience data table. The other thing that why the experience data will be very important is state regulators want to develop some experience data benchmarks so that when a company files their PBR report, the state regulator can see if all of the assumptions that are disclosed in that report are within the industry average benchmark. So just to give you an example, let's say mortality ranges anywhere from, say, 40% of the industry table to 100% of the industry table. So we can kind of think of that as the industry range. So if we saw a company file a PBR report and their mortality experience is 10% of the industry table, doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong, but the examiner would need to look very closely at that particular company's experience because they are using something that's outside an experience data benchmark, if you will. So that concludes my brief overview of the principle-based valuation process and where it's at. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Dave Navy, and he's going to talk more in detail about modeling and go from there.
All right, thank you. Good to be here and to share a little bit about principle-based reserves. I've been sort of living this for the last decade or so, working through the American Academy of Actuaries, so I still can't quite believe it's actually going to maybe be passed and adopted and actually go into practice, so we're getting close. So what I'd like to focus on is the cash flow models and the importance of cash flow models, particularly not only from the perspective of companies, but primarily from the perspective of regulators. Because as Larry went into in his introduction, there's a whole new paradigm now. Rather than using sort of static fixed factors, companies are going to have to, every valuation date, do a redo of the reserve through a cash flow model. So we'll talk about what goes into those models and the challenges thereon. And I'm also going to spend a little time talking about the LIFE PBR framework and how that works and the importance of models in those calculations. And then I'll try to end up with a little discussion on how regulators might approve and or validate the models that are being used by companies. So first of all, just this is a little bit of a repeat over what Larry said. Obviously, PBR, as Larry went through, is a different paradigm. Rather than having a locked-in reserve factor that you sort of lock in at issue and you can kind of forget about it and just pull that factor out every year when you do your reserve calculation, that is being replaced with a modeling sort of approach that brings into the equation or into the calculation more than just interest and mortality. It brings in policyholder behavior risks. It brings in a more dynamic economic reflection of the economics, interest rates, equity returns, et cetera, defaults on assets. And all this really, all this will require the use of a pretty robust asset and liability cash flow model. So, again, a little bit of a repeat from what Larry mentioned. Why are we moving in this direction? Well, products have become more complex. There's more sort of unusual or creative benefits that policyholders are now sort of demanding or expecting. On the asset side, assets have gotten more complicated and more exotic, and because of these factors, the current formulaic approach of locking in a reserve factor at issue just isn't working very well anymore. And as Larry pointed out, this can create a situation where reserves are too high for some products and perhaps too low for others. And if they're too high, that's passing on unnecessary costs to consumers. And if the reserves are too low, it can put companies at risk and jeopardize the protection to the consumers. So this new alignment is attempting to more right-size the reserve that really reflects the real risks of the company, as Larry went over in some detail. So cash flow models are very important. There are some risks and benefits that you really can't capture until you do a modeling exercise under a variety of scenarios. For example, if you have a guaranteed benefit that comes into play under certain conditions, maybe in some low interest rate environments, that becomes a very the product will get in the money. If interest rates are high, it won't. Other products, maybe there's more risk if interest rates go up. So the purpose here is to model the future, as Larry said, more of a focus on what's going to happen into the future rather than what's happened in the past, to model different economic environments into the future as well as different policyholder behavior patterns, and then to see what kind of reserve or what kind of funds are needed to fund those benefits under those different scenarios. So a robust cash flow model, both on the asset side and the liability side, is really required. Now, many companies will use their existing cash flow testing models. It isn't like this is a brand new thing. Companies have been performing cash flow testing for a number of years, and many companies will just use those models, or perhaps they might need to make some modifications in order to be fully compliant with the PBR requirements. So what are the types of models that companies may be using? They may develop their own internal model, just sort of from scratch, although most companies will probably purchase a commercial model of some sort purchased from a vendor, and perhaps maybe need to modify that. One of the key decisions that will need to be made is that, am I going to group data into cells, or am I going to use a seriatim or a policy-by-policy model? Obviously, a policy-by-policy model where you're looking at every policy and projecting out the cash flows on each policy can get pretty cumbersome as far as runtime. So many companies will group policies into cells, so maybe all the policies issued from age 40 to 49 are all grouped into a 45-year cell, for example. So that grouping is a key component of how you sort of organize or build a model. And then there's the asset versus the liability model. Some models have them sort of put together. Other companies have separate sort of models for the asset side and then for the liability side. Asset model, of course, projecting all the investment cash flows off of the assets that the company has. And the liability cash flows are projecting all the benefits and expenses and obligations on the outside, on the outflow that the company is going to have to pay. So the basic elements that go into a model are the actual in-force policies. So there'll need to be some listing of the in-force policies, giving such thing as things as the age, the premium that's being collected, any benefits or guarantees, cash surrender values, those sorts of things. All the details around the sort of the obligations and the characteristics of the policies. Then there'll need to be a listing of the assets, list of bonds or commercial mortgages or the assets that are backing those policies. Then there'll need to be modeling assumptions as far as what are policyholders, what kind of behavior will they exhibit as far as lapses, perhaps policy loans, perhaps surrenders. Obviously, mortality is not a policyholder behavior. We don't decide generally when we die. But that obviously would need to be a key input. And then, as I mentioned, perhaps there'd be some customization to a vendor software to reflect unique product features. So let's talk just a little bit more about the assumptions. This is, again, a key foundation of a principle-based approach. Again, not just a locked-in interest rate and mortality assumption, but more of a company-driven assumptions. Now, there's kind of two categories of assumptions that go into these models, what I would call prescribed assumptions and prudent estimate assumptions. There will still be some prescribed assumptions, and that's where every company will have to use the same assumptions. But prudent assumptions are going to be sort of unique to each policy or each company reflecting their own risks. So prescribed assumptions are set for those risks where the company has very little or no influence over the control of the outcome. For example, interest rate movements. Companies can't control that. They don't know what's going to happen as far as interest rates or equity movements. Asset defaults, of course, that's something that sort of is outside their control based on economic conditions. Spreads in the market on new asset purchases. So for these kinds of assumptions, companies are going to have to use a set of prescribed assumptions. However, prudent estimate assumptions are those where the company practice has some degree of influence over the outcome. If you have really tight underwriting versus very loose underwriting on the mortality side, you can expect better or worse mortality. Lapse assumptions may differ by the types of benefits or features in the contract. So lapse and surrender experience may differ by company. So these estimates, again, as Larry indicated, more of a look toward the future. What is the actuary's anticipated experience? What do we anticipate will happen on these risk factors into the future? Determine that and then add a provision, a margin is what we call it, for adverse deviation. And these are some of the examples: mortality, lapse, expenses, premium funding patterns. Those policies that have variable premiums might have quite a range of potential ups and downs in those premium patterns depending on policyholder behavior.